From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. How do U.S. corporations claim so many of the same rights that humans have, such as the right to free speech? After all, we human beings are tangible persons with cognitive abilities, but corporations are abstract notions. They're institutions created for practical reasons. When the rights of corporations are given the same weight as the rights of humans, how does this impact real people? Well, the fight to give corporations many of these rights has a long history in the U.S. It involves the end of slavery, the civil rights movement, and numerous Supreme Court decisions in landmark cases. In his latest book, UCLA law professor Adam Winkler tells the story of how corporations won their civil rights. Professor Winkler's writings have appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Review of Books, and more. He's the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, and he now joins me to discuss his latest book, We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. Welcome to the program, Adam Winkler.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So this is such an interesting and fascinating story. We hear a lot of contemporary battles over the Citizens United decision, which gives corporations the right to spend unlimited money because the Supreme Court decided that their money was equivalent to our free speech. But that goes all the way back to, as you point out in the opening of your book, to the use of the 14th Amendment to start to give corporations some of the same rights as people. The 14th Amendment was intended to bring equality to formerly enslaved Americans. How did corporations use that?
Well, that's right. The 14th Amendment was adopted after the Civil War to protect the rights of the newly freed slaves. But in a remarkable series of cases in the 1880s, the Southern Pacific Railroad Company brought several cases to the Supreme Court, what its lawyers called test cases, seeking expansive rights under the 14th Amendment for business corporations. And there were two cases that made it to the Supreme Court, each one more bizarre than the next. The first one involved an illustrious lawyer who had himself been nominated and confirmed to the United States Supreme Court, but declined the seat, who went to the Supreme Court and lied and said that when he was a drafter of the 14th Amendment way back when, as a young man in Congress, that he had intended to protect business corporations too when they wrote the 14th Amendment. And then in the second case—
And who was this man?
This was a man named Roscoe Conkling. He was a leader of the Republican Party for about a decade and a half after the Civil War. And he had been on the committee that had drafted the 14th Amendment. And he said that the committee's drafters had intended to protect business corporations too, which it turns out was absolutely not true, and there's no evidence to support that.
So the case with the Southern Pacific Railroad Company, you said was one of a test case. So this was a long project where people started to see that the freedom and equality of formerly enslaved Americans could be a great vehicle to give corporations more rights.
Isn't it remarkable? But indeed, that's exactly what happened. The Southern Pacific Railroad assembled an all-star team of lawyers. One thing that the corporations have always had the benefit of is having the money and resources to hire the best, most expensive lawyers in the country to make the most novel, creative, cutting-edge arguments, whereas civil rights organizations have often lacked those resources. And Roscoe Conkling was one of those illustrious lawyers, and he went and, like I said, he lied to the Supreme Court, and then the court didn't rule on his case, but a couple years later, another one of the Southern Pacific Railroad's test cases came before the justices. And even though the court specifically said in that case they're not ruling that corporations have 14th Amendment rights, a justice who was really determined to give those rights to corporations a couple years later cited that case and said, indeed, the court held that corporations are people too under the 14th Amendment. And ever since then, corporations have amassed a wide number of constitutional rights.
When we think of the United States Constitution, we think of it as the sacred document that gave people their rights. Had to be amended several times to actually expand the notion of people to women, to non-whites. But still, people, we the people. Did the founders intend, as far as we know from history, for corporations to be treated as people?
There's no evidence that the framers were ever thinking about corporations when they wrote the Constitution. Corporations were never mentioned as potential holders of constitutional rights, but that didn't stop corporations from claiming those rights. And in fact, they did it very shortly after the framing. The first Supreme Court case on whether corporations were protected by the Constitution was decided in 1809. That's a half century before the first Supreme Court case on whether African Americans had rights under the Constitution. So wow. Even from our very earliest days, corporations have been pursuing those rights. And whereas minorities and women, as you know, Sonali, lost most of their cases for most of Supreme Court history, the corporations won that first case back in 1809 and have amassed a remarkable record of success ever since.
So in a way, corporations have been fighting for civil rights and winning for longer than African Americans, for example.
Well, and we shouldn't confuse the two. I mean, look, the struggle for civil rights for racial minorities and equal rights for women and equal rights for LGBT people. People risked their lives and lost their lives in those struggles. Corporations never did so.
Because they have no lives to lose.
They have no lives to lose, and corporations don't parade down the street or march with signs demanding equality. But they have had this 200-year campaign in the Supreme Court to gain ever greater rights under the Constitution, and today have nearly all the same rights as you and me.
Tell us about the role of Thurgood Marshall and how his work ended up laying the groundwork for rights for corporations.
Well, that's right. One of the surprising stories I found in my book is that there was a civil rights case in the late 1950s where Thurgood Marshall goes to the Supreme Court arguing for constitutional rights for corporations. He was not thinking about business corporations. He was trying to protect the NAACP, which was organized as a nonprofit corporation. And southern states that were trying to put the NAACP out of business were using its corporate status to try to undermine the organization. And the NAACP goes to the Supreme Court, and it claims it has a constitutional right of freedom of association and to be free of some of these unwanted restrictions and regulations. A case that then's used later by business corporations to expand their own protections and their own rights.
So we've been talking about how corporations are these abstract notions. I think it's certainly worth it for us to just focus a little bit on how it even got to be that that corporations became this thing, this abstract notion around which the economy was then built. What is the origin story of the corporation?
Well, the first corporations were formed 300 years before the birth of Christ in ancient Rome. And they were just devices as today, devices so that people could pool their money together to accomplish something like to form a business and to be able to run the business without being disrupted anytime someone wants to sell their shares or quit the business. And they've been very effective at that tool. And in fact, even in ancient Rome, the corporation became very common for mining operations, for tax collection, for building aqueducts. And indeed, even from the earliest days, corporations were a great threat to public health because the early Roman mining corporations, it turns out that they've done some ice core samples and found evidence of widespread global pollution caused by Roman mining corporations operating 300 years before the birth of Christ. So from the get-go, they've always been a danger to the public health.
Wow. So we talked about the use of the 14th Amendment in the Southern Pacific Railroad case. There's also the story of how corporations were steadily gaining more rights is also intertwined with the Dred Scott decision. Tell us that story.
Well, that's right. I mentioned earlier in that early 1809 case where corporations first sought constitutional rights. Well, the provision that they sought rights under was a provision of the Constitution that refers to citizens having the right to sue in federal court. That was the exact same provision that was at issue in the Dred Scott case. And the Supreme Court in Dred Scott held that African Americans could not be citizens under this provision of the Constitution that years earlier the Supreme Court said corporations could be citizens under. So unlike racial minorities, corporations did have rights the white man was bound to respect, as Dred Scott kind of referred to it.
One of the figures in your book, We the Corporations, is someone that probably most Americans have never heard of, Daniel Webster, who played a huge role in helping corporations win civil rights. Who was he and what role did he play?
So Daniel Webster is considered one of the legendary orators in American history and maybe the greatest Supreme Court advocate ever. Argued more than 220 cases in the Supreme Court in the early 1800s, when most of the provisions of the Constitution were just first being interpreted. So he had an enormous influence. And he had that influence on behalf of big business. His clients were almost exclusively businesses and corporations, and many of his biggest cases were cases going to the Supreme Court arguing for rights for corporations. And it kind of highlights, again, that one thing that corporations have always had the advantage of in seeking civil rights over, say, racial minorities or women, is that whereas the civil rights campaigns for women and minorities were generally underfunded, corporations always had the resources to fight for their rights in court. And it's important to recognize that although we think of the court system as being a level playing field with blind justice, if you can afford the best lawyers, you're going to do better in court.
Right. How did justices themselves on the Supreme Court, through their lens of being favoring corporations, end up furthering corporate rights? It's not just the attorneys, right?
No. And in fact, because this is a story of Supreme Court cases, not, say, marching across a bridge in Alabama. This is really about Supreme Court cases, and ultimately Supreme Court cases are about the justices and the rulings that they make. The story of corporate rights takes us through some very colorful justices, from the justice who misled the Supreme Court about the nature of the 14th Amendment and the earlier Southern Pacific Railroad case, was a justice by the name of Stephen Field. He was known to carry a gun with him, even under his robe, and he's the only sitting justice ever arrested, and the charge was murder, no less. So
wow.
There are a lot of colorful characters in the story of corporate rights, including some ones like Lewis Powell, the author of the infamous Powell Memorandum, who, when he was on the Supreme Court, became a vocal advocate for the political speech rights of business corporations.
So this story is one that spans hundreds of years, and yet there's a movement today to revoke personhood for corporations. I mean, looking at your book and reading through it, it seems like an insurmountable task because we're talking about hundreds of years of precedence of case law that has established so many different rights. Are there any rights that corporations don't have that human beings do have?
Well, sure, there are definitely rights that corporations do not have. They don't have the right to vote. They don't have the right to run for office. And none's ever gone to the Supreme Court claiming a right to, say, keep and bear arms. Hmm. Although given the strength of the NRA, maybe that's only days away. So there are rights that they don't have, often rights that are, but we're seeing an increasing effort by corporations to gain more rights. And so in recent years, we've seen not only corporations win the right of political speech in Citizens United, but we've also seen corporations win the rights of religious freedom, at least under a federal statute, in the Hobby Lobby case, and giving that big chain of craft stores an exemption from a requirement to cover birth control in employee health plans.
Right. So that fight is still continuing today. It's not just something that happened hundreds of years ago. That it's a project that began and continues through to the Citizens United case in 2010 and then the Hobby Lobby case. So we're still seeing corporations try to, fight for their rights.
There is a movement to amend the Constitution, as
right.
you mentioned. There's 19 states have endorsed a constitutional amendment that would overturn Citizens United and declare that corporations have no rights and are not people. I'm very sympathetic to that effort because one story that my book makes clear is that corporations have really seized power in the courts by claiming these constitutional rights. I wonder if that movement, amendment, though, isn't a little too broad. It would say that, for instance, Apple couldn't fight against the government if the government wanted to force it to open up an iPhone of a suspected terrorist because Apple as a corporation would not have any rights. It wouldn't have a right of due process of law or a right of privacy. It seems to me that the New York Times and CNN, both corporations, need some protection. Otherwise, Donald Trump is going to censor them the way the Huey Long tried to censor the Louisiana newspapers in the 1930s.
In fact, tell us about Huey Long. You brought up Donald Trump and the era of fake news that we today, you know, hear that phrase over and over again. But Huey Long was somebody who perpetrated the notion of fake news in this fight for corporations to win rights. Who was Huey Long? What did he do?
So Huey Long was the iron-fisted governor and then senator from Louisiana in the 1930s. And he was Trump before Trump. He was a populist who won on a big campaign to make Louisiana great again at the time of the Great Recession. And when the big newspapers in Louisiana came out against Long and his demagoguery and his corruption, he appointed a lot of his friends to high positions. Sound familiar? Long accused the media of publishing fake news and imposed a tax on the newspaper companies, what Long called a tax, quote, online, 2 cents per lie. And the newspaper companies challenged that law in court and ended up winning a landmark Supreme Court case saying that not only really invigorating and broadening the protections of the freedom of the press against censorship, an important precedent for even today, but also said that corporations, these newspaper corporations, had that right of free press too. And many of the biggest freedom of the press cases ever since involve business corporations. The movie The Post that's so popular is really a movie about a business corporation asserting a constitutional right.
Wow. So there are some interesting unexpected angles to the constitutional rights of corporations that involve the free press. Now, in your story, you figure Ralph Nader, one of the most well-known consumer advocates in the nation. He's been a guest on our show a few times. He's considered, you know, a progressive hero, but his work also plays into the story of corporations and their rights. How so?
Yeah, it's one of the really sort of shocking turnarounds is that Ralph Nader, in some ways, really laid an important foundation for Citizens United. In the 1970s, at the height of Nader's popularity, he brought a Supreme case to the Supreme Court on behalf of consumers seeking to overturn some restrictions on the ability of pharmacists to advertise their drug prices. And he won that case, and the Supreme Court adopted Ralph Nader's theory of the First Amendment, which was that if speech was valuable to the listeners, that is, to the consumers, then it was protected regardless of the identity of the speaker. And that same precedent gets used years later in Citizens United, where the court says that corporations have free speech rights because what they have to say will be valued by the listeners. And so the First Amendment theory that Citizens United relied upon was first introduced into the law by Ralph Nader.
My goodness. I mean, I'm sure he didn't mean for any of that.
Of course not. And this is not to say that Ralph Nader was involved in some corporate conspiracy.
Right.
But what it does highlight, I think, Sonali, is that throughout constitutional history, corporations have been incredibly good at leveraging progressive reforms to serve the ends of capital. We saw that with the 14th Amendment, and we see it. The First Amendment was invigorated to protect the rights of dissenters and anarchists and socialists and communists who were outcasts. But today, 50% of First Amendment cases are brought by business corporations and trade associations that represent business corporations.
Wow.
So we've really seen corporations seize these progressive reforms for their own purposes.
Going back finally then to what you were saying about the move to amend the constitutions to sort of take back some of those rights and reserve them for actual human beings, what advice would you give to groups wanting to do that, to individuals wanting to do that, that corporations maybe should retain a few basic modest rights that could protect them from government incursion, but then be stripped of rights that they shouldn't have?
Yeah, I think the question isn't whether corporations should have rights, it's which rights they should have. Mm. And for the longest time, actually, the Supreme Court drew a pretty sensible line, I think. They said corporations should have property rights, but not liberty rights. That is to say, if the government wants to seize your building and your factories, the government has to pay just compensation under the Constitution. And if the government wants to charge you with a crime, you have a right of due process, a right to appear in court and defend yourself and force the government to prove its charges beyond a reasonable doubt, even if you're a corporation. But what the court said is that corporations don't have liberty rights, rights associated with personal conscience and autonomy and political freedom. And indeed, 100 years ago, before Citizens United, the courts universally upheld campaign finance restrictions on business corporations, saying that the right to influence elections is the kind of right that belongs to natural persons, not artificial persons.
Well, and also because we live at a time when income inequality, wealth inequality is, unprecedented. It's the gap just keeps getting wider. Corporations have seemingly unlimited resources to pour into the efforts to retain and even expand their rights. And so it's sort of intimately connected to how the rest of society is progressing.
Well, and that's right. And corporations are only gaining more and more power. We saw in the recent tax bill that it's really a big giveaway to big corporations and taking away from the neediest Americans. And one of the stories that I tell is that in the book, we're seeing corporations gain even more power in the courts. Over the last 20 years, we've seen the rise of an elite Supreme Court bar that's especially persuasive and influential at the Supreme Court, led by Ted Olson, the famed lawyer who argued the Citizens United case and won those new rights for corporations. And that the existence of this bar is one that really enhances the power and influence of corporations in the courts, too. It's something we really need to be concerned about and wary of.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Adam Winkler, and thank you for the work you've done.
Thanks so much for having me.
Adam Winkler is a professor of law at UCLA. His writings have appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Review of Books, and more. His earlier book was Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. We've been discussing his newest book, We, the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.